From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Want to know how to make peace in a violent world? Consider the female chimpanzee.
Females will, for example, monitor the fights between males, and if these males don't reconcile after the fight, she will go over there and she will start grooming one of these two males. And after a few minutes, she will bring the other male with her. If the male doesn't want to follow, she will take his arm and make him follow. And then she will bring the two males together, and these males are then supposed to groom each other, and they often do.
Renowned primatologist Franz de Waal. We'll hear more about the moral lives of chimpanzees later this hour. First, though, Anne Strainchamps is in the studio with me, and she has a remarkable story. It's about a woman who says she grew up without any human contact. Her only companions were monkeys. And what's the story?
Well, Jim, you know, throughout history, we've heard these stories about kids who've been abandoned in the wilderness and somehow survived growing up as feral children. And then years later, they're discovered and brought back into human society. And some of these have later turned out to be hoaxes or urban legends, but they've been around a long time. And another one of these has just surfaced.
And it's in South America?
Right, in Colombia. So it's the story of a woman named Marina Chapman, who's a grandmother, lives in England. And she recently came forward with a story that is kind of verges on the unbelievable. But she says that when she was a very little girl living in Colombia, she was kidnapped and abandoned in the jungle, where she lived for years with no companions other than a group of monkeys. Later, she was found by hunters. She lived in a series of miserable circumstances, was finally rescued and moved to England. And she's now come forward with her story in a memoir called The Girl with No Name. And I had a chance to sit down with her and with her daughter, Vanessa James. Marina, you have this extraordinary story. What's your very first memory of living on your own in the jungle?
Very bad. I was very, very upset, crying, hoping those two men come back for me. Even they were bad. I just want somebody to not to leave me alone in there, because it became really not very nice.
Now, as far as you can tell, you were about 5 at the time?
I was waiting for, I think, a 5th birthday for some reason. Maybe perhaps I was going to be 5.
Huh. So these kidnappers came, and there were a bunch of other children in the truck, but then they took you out and ran into the jungle with you and then just abandoned you?
They left me there and they ran away.
What did you do?
I would just cry. I only remember being crying, and I just couldn't think anything else but hoping that somebody would come and collect me, and wait and wait, and it never happened. And you stay hungry for a long time.
Did you try to find your way out of the jungle?
The problem with that is so big. Everything is so big, and you no idea which way to go. You try, but then you can't find the way out sometimes. I did find a pond of water, and that was really nice for me to find that water. And whenever I feel thirsty, I used to drink it.
One of the really extraordinary things about your story is that you wound up connecting with a tribe of wild monkeys and living with them or surrounded by them for a long time.
I didn't know there were monkeys there.
So how did you encounter the monkeys?
I didn't. They found me.
What did they look like?
They were all similar. They were so very pale brown, and you can tell some of them were bigger than the others or more in charge. There was a particular one, it looked like it was in charge, came towards me. And then as he gets closer to me, then he started to look at my face, and then he started to poke it with a finger, and he just trying to see what sort of things I do to them. Also, I didn't do anything. I was very upset and just tied my body, and I just, you know, trying to move backwards, but
you must have been terrified.
I was. But then you have mixed feeling. It could be terrified, but it could be fun, because when you see somebody around you, it feels like you're not lonely. But then you don't know what to do with these things, with these animals. You know what you're supposed to do.
Vanessa, you had a lot to do with your mother publishing this story. Did you grow up knowing she had had this experience?
Yeah, we just heard stories growing up. If we were cooking together, one of the ingredients would remind her of something in the jungle or just day-to-day life. For Mum, growing up, it wasn't ever a very clear story for Mum because her whole story has been quite muddled in her mind. It's been little bits of memories here and there, but not enough really to form a full story.
So it wasn't like, oh, let me tell you about the time that, you know, Monkey and I did this or that.
Yeah, no, it never has been. But also Mum's never thought it was anything different or special to be able to sit us down and say, this is what happened to me, here's a story. You know, we didn't ask questions because it was just normal. It just fell out.
But there must have been a point, that is strange. I mean, there must have been a point at which it hit you, wow, this is really unusual. Yeah. Most people's mothers don't have stories like this.
When we had a few more school friends and we saw how their mums were and how they, you know, they would sit still and maybe watch TV, where it's like my mum would find things to do and invent things, catch a bird, or we'd go climb a tree, or that was normal for me.
Catch a bird?
But yeah, she's caught birds before.
In her bare hands?
Yeah. That's how we had our first pet, called Mopsy. She was a flea bag, but my mum caught that with her bare hands. She didn't like pet shops.
Wait, what was this? She just went out in the countryside and caught you a bunny?
Yeah.
Yes, that's... it's easy.
It is? How do you do it?
Well, I just catch it now, and I don't think anything about it.
Fast reflexes.
You're used to it.
But I think I only realised the story and, you know, it really hit me with writing this book because, as I say, Mum's memories have always been a bit disjointed. Mm. But when I was able to link them together and figure out the time zones and which memory belonged to what time zone, we got to see how it really did match up and it was a chronological whole story. And that's when we all the family kind of went, wow, this makes sense. This is how it's all the memories tied together. So for us, that was probably a really great time. And that was the whole reason for the book, to keep it in the family originally.
So once you began to put it together, I mean, chronologically, as best as you can make out, how does it go? What did happen to your mother?
I could give you a nutshell.
Sure.
The way we figured it out is Mum remembers being kidnapped when she was about to be 5. She got taken to the jungle, and we've worked out that she lived there about 5 years, although...
We're not sure.
And she got hunted out by some monkey hunters who Mum had revealed herself to because she saw the woman's face and felt she was compassionate. And then she got sold to a brothel house by these hunters, which was a shame. But because Mum was so feral, she couldn't be used as one of the working girls, and so she was put to work as a slave or a maid, and she wasn't able to figure things out like cleaning or twisting things or cutlery or beds, so she got abused and shouted at a lot. She eventually ran to the streets and became a street kid there for what we've worked out is about 2 or 3 years. She then moved into a house with a family who she said she would be a maid for if she could live under their roof. And again, finding it hard to just adapt to a lot of things, they would shout at her a lot, and that was quite abusive. And the next door neighbours would hear her shouting, and eventually were the ones that rescued her and pulled her out of that house. They flew her over to the capital city in Bogota, where their daughter was, and that's where she got adopted, and things got better from there.
Fantastic, yeah.
But that's taken a long time for us to see that chronologically.
Mm. Marina, how did you wind up, I mean, fast forward, how did you wind up living in Yorkshire, England, and married and raising a family?
People were so caring and so nice. They were trying to train me in a way to walk. One of them was the wife or the school inspector. And she just was perfect person. And she taught me how to be hygienic and things like that in my life.
She often got criticised as a mum with people saying, oh, you shouldn't be climbing trees around your kids. They're going to get picked on. And so it was a shame that people said that, because to us, Mum was the best mum you could imagine. And her only example was obviously the monkey family. So they must be good examples. They're good parents.
Well, you said climbing trees. I would guess if you've lived with monkeys, you mean something more than just climbing up to one or two of the first branches.
Mum gets as high as possible, but we couldn't get as high as Mum. She gets up to the tree where it starts getting really wispy and starts bending over. That's the point where we start shouting, Mum, get down. But she starts shaking the branches.
Do you remember learning that from the monkeys or copying them in the rainforest? Do you remember learning how to climb?
I think I was remember when they used to go and get the food. I managed to climb a tree and I discovered where they're getting the food from. That was fantastic. And I learned how to steal from myself. And there, they don't help you. You just have to do it yourself. And if you don't eat it quickly, they take it away from you.
You would have to compete with them for food?
No.
Would they come snatch it out of your hands?
They do. I suppose it was very useful when I went to the street because I was very speedy, faster than most of the street children, really. They couldn't climb trees and they couldn't escape like me. I managed to get away from the police many times.
You know, there's so much in the jungle that is poisonous. You could so easily have eaten. I mean, didn't you ever get sick?
Yeah, I did. I ate the wrong stuff. The monkeys never ate that. And I just by mistake, I thought it looks like a tamarindo, but it wasn't. And I was really sick. I never felt so sick in my life. I was just shaking and this monkey keep watching me in the corner, staring at me. And it's funny how that monkey made me drink water, very brutal way he did it.
Wait, the monkey made you drink water?
Well, I thought he was going to kill me, really. I something like that. I wasn't sure, but I thought he hated me. Mm-hmm. And he made me drink all this water, and I vomit. And then after the vomit, and I realized I felt quite good.
He had shoved Mum towards this water pool quite forcefully and Mum was feeling quite ill, so she went with it. And he was just really pushing her head under the water as if to say, drink this, and she thought he was trying to drown her. Mm. But he was just trying to push her head down towards the water to drink. And you say that he had a moment where you looked in his eyes and you knew that he wasn't out there to attack you.
He wasn't angry, no.
No, he was trying to help.
He was serene, and if something I felt quite good when I look at his face, I thought, oh, he's not angry.
And if you were there for as long as you think you were there,
I hope so.
Did you lose human language, do you think?
I wonder sometimes what language I spoke, because when I came out of there, I didn't know what to say. I was just making noises. But apart from that, I didn't manage to understand what they were talking about. And that was really, really tough.
So you sort of had to relearn human language.
I have to in the city, and I learn with the children. You always learn faster with the children because they treat better what the humans beat you if you don't remember, you know.
You know, I would imagine that someone with the kind of experiences you've had would have a hard time trusting other people as an adult. Has that been an issue?
It's been very difficult to trust people, believe me. It's not been easier. But for some reason, I met Maruja, the neighbor, and it was something about her and her son was very different people.
This is the family that took you in eventually?
The neighbor that rescued her.
It's an incredible woman.
What's interesting about looking at Mum is that she was so aware of how far a little bit of love went with that neighbour, Maruja. And, you know, after having 15 years of so much abuse from humans, seeing how powerful a little bit of love was, every time Mum now sees a kid on the street that's struggling or is a bit of a pest, and most people would just say, how annoying they are. Mum would say, all they need is a bit of love, and she'll go up and she'll talk to them and he'll just make sure that they've got what they need, love, because she knows how far that goes. So it's almost turned backwards in an incredible way.
Vanessa James and her mother, Marina Chapman, talking with Anne Strangechamps about Marina's memoir, The Girl with No Name. She was in her 20s when Marina moved with her Colombian family to England. There, she married the local church organist and she raised a family. Now, when we heard this story, we really had a basic question. Did it happen? And we're not the only ones who wondered. Philip Sherwell, a reporter for the British paper The Sunday Telegraph, went to Colombia to check on the story.
Philip, the first question we had after hearing Marina Chapman's story is, frankly, whether or not to believe it. You had some similar questions.
Yeah, yes, we did. My newspaper decided they'd actually like me to go down to Colombia to kind of investigate, as far as one could, this truly almost impossible-to-believe story.
So did you just go down to Colombia blind to try to find somebody who might have known her?
So we interviewed two members of the family that took her in after she'd been living rough down in this Colombian border city of Cúcuta, and after she'd been sort of taken in and virtually as a domestic slave by another household, she was rescued by an old family matriarch who lived nearby, and she was taken in by this second family, and they were the people who I spoke to. Now, one of them refers to herself as her sister. I mean, as far as they were concerned, they adopted Marina, and the other member of the family refers to himself as her cousin.
So they remember her from her time in Colombia. They probably remember her as either a house slave or a homeless child, but they don't necessarily remember or know anything about her time in the jungle, correct?
Correct. But when I spoke to them, they both had fairly detailed memories of the stories as a child she would tell of her time in the jungle, of living with monkeys, of her kidnap, of her abduction. And one of the things that most reassured me, actually, and in journalism one is often looking for consistency of stories, was that there were some inconsistencies in the way they remembered this. And I would have been very suspicious, actually, to be perfectly frank, if they had remembered stories that were being told to them by a girl from 50 years ago in an entirely consistent manner. That would then smack to me of people who'd got their story together for, you know, for, mm-hmm. for whatever purposes. They largely remembered crucial details in a similar fashion. The towns matched up, the overall stories matched up, and there were crucial details in what was told to me that made me believe that there was certainly a lot to what her story consists of.
Now, if the stories she tells of living in the jungle from the time she was, you know, 5 years old or so, for 5 years, she says, if that's true, you would think she would have been a very odd little girl, odd enough that people would have noticed. How did they describe her?
Well, they do remember great oddities, striking oddities about her. As I say, one thing was her tendency to run up trees. In fact, Nancy, the adoptive sister, says her first memory of Marina was seeing this little girl, who she didn't know who she was seeing her perched up a mango tree. They also, the cousin sort of said to me, she was always so sort of like physically strong for a slight figure. I mean, obviously she'd not been eating particularly well, but she was very strong and wiry. And they do remember her making sort of monkey-like noises, eating, or animal-like noises, eating in an odd manner. They remember a number of oddities. Yeah. She had not come straight out of the jungle and ending up with these people. You know, she'd been somewhat sort of reacclimatized by living rough in a city where she was first made to work as a cleaner in a brothel and then sort of working as a domestic slave in another household. So there had been some reacclimatization with society, but nonetheless, they do remember those oddities.
The part about living in the jungle is the part that's, you know, sort of hard to believe, and especially because she says she was so little, I don't know, 5 years old. I mean, did you talk with, I don't know, primatologists or people who knew
Yes.
the jungle very well?
Yeah, I did, and their view was it's incredibly unlikely. I did speak to a primate expert. He thought if she wasn't threatening, she was small enough not to be threatening. If she didn't cause the monkeys and the colony a problem, they might have accepted her in around the edges. Equally, he'd never heard of such a case in South America before. Mm. You know, if true, and I keep having to say that, it's quite remarkable.
Remarkable things do happen.
They'd say, we've never heard of it, but, you know, hey, it could be possible.
So, Philip, in the end, did you yourself find her story credible?
That is the great question, isn't it? I found it remarkable, but I didn't establish anything when I was there that would make me believe that she'd made it up or that it was impossible, but just that it would be a truly and utterly stunningly unique story. That's really as far as I got.
Philip Sherwell was the U.S. editor of the Sunday Telegraph when he reported on that story. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. Coming up, renowned primatologist Franz de Waal. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Want to start an argument? Try this question on for size. Are humans unique, one of a kind, or are we really not that different from our ape cousins, chimpanzees? Steve Paulson's here in the studio with me, and he's been pushing that question around among scientists. It's a hot debate.
It is. This debate over human uniqueness really stirs up a lot of scientists, especially, and it raises all kinds of questions about the nature of language, about tool use, and ultimately about what does it mean to be human? Do we stand apart from the rest of the animal world? And one of the most fascinating perspectives comes from Frans de Waal, who's a prominent biologist at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta, and he's been studying chimpanzees and bonobos for decades.
And he finally has a new book out about it, right?
He does. It's called The Bonobo and the Atheist. And basically, Frans de Waal is asking whether we can find the building blocks of morality in chimps and bonobos. So I was really curious to hear what he's found out so far when I had the chance to talk with him.
Of course, to the biologist, we are animals. So for the biologist, that's hard to believe that we are fundamentally different because we have the same brains. And there's actually no part in the human brain that is not present in a monkey brain. So the brains are bigger. And we certainly have, let's say, a more powerful computer than any other animal. But the computer is not fundamentally different.
So there's no fundamental divide between humans and, let's say, chimpanzees?
No. If you would ask me what is the big difference, I would say it's probably language. But even, it's like with all capacities, if you break them down in pieces, you're going to find some of these pieces in some other species. And that's what I'm doing with morality, obviously. I break it into pieces and I say, well, this piece we can find in chimpanzees and this piece. I'm not sure we find the whole thing, morality as we know it in humans. But we're finding a lot of bits and pieces that I call the building blocks of morality.
Well, you've spent decades studying non-human primates. Can you give me some sense of a chimpanzee's morality?
Well, a chimpanzee's morality, they have a sense of fairness. They are cooperative animals like we are. And if you cooperate, you need to watch what you get out of the cooperation. So if I cooperate with you, and let's say I'm go hunting with you regularly, and you always take the best pieces of meat and I get very little scraps, that's not a good partnership for me. And so I need to be sensitive to that. And we find that chimpanzees and bonobos are sensitive to fairness. We find that they can be empathic, that they respond to the distress of others by reassuring others and sharing food with them and that kind of things. We do actually experiments on that.
How do you experiment with that? I mean, how do you do that experiment?
Well, a typical experiment like that is that you put two chimpanzees who normally live together, so they know each other. You put them side by side in two rooms. And then you let one of them choose between two tokens, let's say blue tokens and red tokens. And if they pick a blue token and they give it to us, they get rewarded for that. If they pick a red token and they give it to us, they get a reward, but also their partner at the same time gets a reward. It doesn't make any difference for them because they get rewarded every time they give us a token. The only difference is that does my partner get something, yes or no? And what we find is that over time, they start to prefer the what we call the pro-social token. They start to prefer the token that rewards the two of them. Hmm. And so we use that as a measure to indicate that chimpanzees do care about the well-being of others.
We should talk about some specific examples that you write about in your book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, which are fascinating, which get to these questions of the moral instincts of chimps and bonobos. For instance, you write about an old female chimp at your colony at Yerkes, Peony. Tell me about her.
She had arthritis. She was very old and could barely move. And so there were cases where we observed that, for example, if she tried to climb into a climbing frame where a bunch of chimps were sitting and grooming each other, she wanted to join them, but she could barely get in there, that younger females would walk up to her and put their hands on her behind and start pushing until she was up there with the rest. We've seen cases where she started walking towards a water faucet. It's a very large enclosure, and so the distances are pretty long. And so since she walks with so much difficulty that we have seen younger females run ahead of her and drink in the water in their own mouth and then walk up back to her and spit it in her mouth. And so she wouldn't need to walk all the way to the faucet, and they would bring her the water.
So you're talking about empathy here. I mean, the capacity to recognize another chimpanzee's pain or difficulties and then to help that animal.
Yeah, empathy is one of those traits that humans overestimate the complexity of. And that's why if you tell the average psychologist, you say there's empathy in animals, they will say, oh, that's not possible. Because they think empathy means that you consciously put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. Now, we know from human research now that that's not the case. In human research, we know there's a lot of empathy, automatic empathy responses. Like, if I'm frowning and looking sad, you're going to be frowning and looking sad because you're going to be affected by my facial emotions. Or if I'm happy and laughing and smiling, you're going to be laughing and smiling. And so there's a lot of bodily connection in human empathy. And that bodily connection, which is usually called emotional contagion, is easily demonstrable in lots of animals. Hmm. And so we test out these bodily connections that exist, and that's how empathy basically starts.
Now, we should say also that chimpanzees have very complicated social lives. I mean, they live in big groups. There's a lot of jockeying for a social status, which is constantly changing among both the males and the females. And there's plenty of competition for food and for mating partners. There's a lot to sort out here, isn't there?
Yeah, that's the interesting part, is that chimpanzees have both sides. They can be very violent and very dominance-oriented, and they defend their territory with lethal aggression. And so chimpanzees can be very nasty, and they can be very cooperative and very friendly. So what species does that remind you of? That's the question. Because people sometimes say, well, if chimpanzees kill each other, how can you call them empathic? Well, the same argument applies to humans. Humans have that whole spectrum also.
And you also say there are cases where two males have been fighting, and then the fight is over, and you know they're kind of licking their wounds. But then there might be a female who comes in and basically pulls those two males together and sort of forces them to make up.
I relate that to what I call community concern. Chimpanzees and bonobos, they seem to have, more than any other animal that I know, they seem to have some understanding of their community as a whole. And they seem to worry about the level of harmony in their group. And so females will, for example, monitor the fights between males. And if these males don't reconcile after the fight, they're going to go over there. It's usually older females who do that, high-ranking older females. She will go over there and she will start grooming one of these two males who doesn't want to reconcile. And after a few minutes, she will mark to the other and bring the other male with her. If the male doesn't want to follow, she will take his arm and make him follow. And then she will bring the two males together, and these males are then supposed to groom each other, and they often do.
And aren't sometimes the males still holding a weapon of some sort? And aren't there cases where the female will take that weapon out of their hand?
Yeah, they take the weapons out of their hands. And only females can do that. A male could not be a mediator, because as soon as a male walks into a scene like that, he's going to be perceived as the buddy of one of the two, as a supporter. And so females are much more effective in that. And then the other way that we see community concern is when males break up fights. And so there are certain high-ranking males who take what we call the control role. And as soon as there's a little fight, even the littlest fight between two juveniles, they will go over there and stop that fight. They will break it up. And it's very important that they do, because small fights, like between two juveniles, they often escalate. I hear that at human daycare centers, that's not unusual also. Mm-hmm. And then it gets much bigger. And so it's very important that they nip these things in the bud.
So there's this whole dynamic kind of built into chimpanzee lives to be pro-social, to get along. That is the dominant ethic, even though there are lots of fights that break out.
Yeah, as I said, they have both sides. And I also compare us with bonobos. And bonobos are equally close to us as chimpanzees. They're more empathic, I think, than chimpanzees.
Well, you call them the politically correct primate.
Yeah, the hippies of the primate world, basically, because they have sex instead of war. And in relation to war, that's what I wanted to mention, is that when bonobo groups meet in the forest, there is some hostility going on, and people have documented that, but very soon they may overcome that and they will have sex with their neighbors.
But you'll have to explain this. So they've just met a rival group of bonobos, and then they suddenly start having sex with them?
Yeah, so they start out with yelling and screaming at each other and being intimidating. So there is some level of hostility. In chimpanzees, it would translate in a big fight in which someone may lose their life. But that's not what happens in bonobos. It has actually never been documented. Hmm. So that's a fundamental difference between bonobos and chimpanzees.
You say in your book that sex is utterly routine among bonobos. I mean, rubbing genitals with another bonobo is kind of like a human blowing his nose.
Yeah, so it's very casual. In bonobos, it's a little greeting of 10 seconds and then it's over. And so they rub their genitals together. They may touch each other's genitals. Sometimes it gets a bit more intensive and more involved. But most of the time, it's a very casual thing. It's like I slap you on the back or something like that.
And one of the other differences is that bonobos are matriarchal. I mean, the females are the dominant ones.
The females are collectively dominant. I would not say that they are individually dominant over the males. They are smaller. They are less muscular. They don't have the big teeth that the males have. But as a collectivity, and bonobos live in an environment where the females can travel together and be together, collectively they dominate the males. And so I find that a very interesting comparison, the contrast between chimps and bonobos on the one hand, and then the comparison with humans.
So the great question here is, which in our evolutionary history are we humans most closely related to? Because as far as we know, our ancestors broke off from the common ancestor of chimpanzees and bonobos at the same time. We're equally related to both. So is our common ancestor more bonobo-like or more chimpanzee-like?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, and we will maybe never know. There's sort of two schools on this. One is the traditional school, because we used to know only chimpanzees. Bonobos were barely known like 25 years ago. And so everyone is focused on the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is violent in their interactions between groups. They have warfare. And so there is a school of anthropologists who believes that you only should look at the chimpanzee and that the bonobo is irrelevant because the chimpanzee fits their thinking about humans being killer apes and being aggressive. And only with time did we become more peaceful. And then there's, of course, another group of people who doesn't believe necessarily that we have always waged war and always been aggressive, that maybe human warfare is a more recent phenomenon, that we have not always been like that, and that the bonobo is actually highly relevant.
So this is a profound question here. I mean, we're really trying to figure out, are humans inherently good with a capacity for evil, or are we inherently evil with a penchant for doing good?
Well, I'm of the school that I think we are inherently good, and we do, under certain circumstances, we do horrible things. And so basically my argument is that this whole resistance to evolution, which comes from fundamental Christians, is partly a resistance to the idea that you could be moral without God.
Frans de Waal is a primatologist at the Yerkes Primate Center. His book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist. If you'd like to read Steve's extended interview with de Waal in the science magazine Nautilus, you'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Chimpanzees are not just fascinating to primatologists, they've also inspired a spate of recent novelists. We're going to talk to two of them who have turned chimps into central characters in their books. The first is Benjamin Hale, and his novel is called The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore. So who is Bruno Littlemore?
Well, Bruno Littlemore is a talking chimpanzee. He's kind of introduced himself into human society, but is always stuck in this in-between space. He's not an animal, and he can't ever be accepted as a human being. He loves humanity, but he also hates it, and he hates himself for his desire to join humanity.
Well, I can see that, because, I mean, you hear it in everything that he says, but it's also more than that. You've made it pretty clear at several points in the novel that this is, in some ways, a retelling of Paradise Lost. It's a different take on how we all try to reconcile the animal in us with our pretense at humanity.
Yeah. No, I mean, Paradise Lost was definitely a major influence on the book. Two of the epigraphs are from Paradise Lost. One of them is when Eve meets Satan in the guise of a talking snake in the Garden of Eden. She says, "What may this mean? Language of man pronounced by tongue of brute and human sense expressed," which I thought was a really beautiful thing. And it's kind of you know, an inspiration for the book. And then the next epigraph in the next section is Satan's response, describing what it's like to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. He says, "Strange alteration came over me, and to degree of reason in my inward powers, and I turned my capacious mind to all things visible in the world, and heaven and the middle, all things fair and good," which is a really just eerie description of what it's like to gain knowledge and gain sin at the same time, which is kind of a theme in the book.
Yeah. Well, this is also, it explains why Bruno at one point calls Lucifer the master orator. It is the tree of life, isn't it? It's the apple that that we should or shouldn't have taken, depending on how you look at it.
Right. Well, language is typically thought to be one of the defining Rubicons that human beings have crossed that other animals just haven't done for whatever reason. And there are two major camps in how we understand language. One is the linguists, and particularly I'm thinking of the Chomsky linguists, and one is the biologists. And the linguists like to think of language as a system. And biologists like to think of language as a behavior. And whether or not you understand language as a system or a behavior radically affects the way that you understand what language is. Like, for instance, Chomsky and linguists would probably argue that nodding, head shaking, pointing, waving, etc., that that's not language, that's gestural communication because it's not grammatical. Essentially, I agree with the biologists that language is primarily there for communication.
You spent a good deal of time studying these people. Did you spend time working with any of them? I mean, Lincoln Park Zoo exists.
Uh-huh.
Did you go there?
Yeah. You know, the kind of initial inspiration for this book is that at the time I was writing it, I was living in Iowa. And my girlfriend at the time lived in Chicago, which, you know, is about a three-hour drive from Iowa. And so the first year that I was there, I probably spent more time in Chicago than in Iowa. And while I was waiting for her to finish work, I would just walk across the street to the Lincoln Park Zoo and just sit there and spend the day watching the chimps, just to, you know, in part to kill time, but also because I've had this lifelong fascination with chimpanzees ever since I was a kid. You know, and it was really fascinating to sit there for 4 or 5 hours at a time in an afternoon and observe the social dynamics between them, like who can beat up on who, who's friends with who, and so on. And I would bring a book with me to read when the chimps weren't doing anything. And, you know, and this is like in the dead of winter in Chicago in January and February. It's like, you know, 0, 10 degrees below outside, and I would be the only person in the zoo. And there was one time in January when it was bitterly cold outside and I was alone in the zoo with the chimps, and the chimps were, you know, napping, and I was reading Portnoy's Complaint, read Philip Roth. And I was reading this book about this guy who has this neurotic pervert who's complaining about his claustrophobic childhood and so on. And I was reading this book and I looked up at the chimps and it was sort of like an idea was born. And so I started writing a book at first purely for my own amusement. And then the book kind of evolved into what it is from there.
You have a lot of, I think fun is the right word. Some people might call it blasphemy. You have a lot of, of fun creating a chimpanzee who almost does become human and then engages in some human activity which we as humans simply can't accept.
Well, that's kind of, the phrasing is kind of funny. It made me think, you know, one man's fun is another man's blasphemy. I mean,
well, and I think that's probably true, and maybe even more so here. Bruno Littlemore becomes involved with Lydia, who is the woman who found him at the zoo and perhaps introduced him to humanity in more ways than anybody ever expected.
Right, yeah. There is some sex in the book. The thing is that I wanted to take Bruno as seriously as I could as a character, and I wanted him to experience the full range of human possibility. Sometimes it irritates me when I read a book and it's just like sex is just not in it. Like the world of sex is missing from the book. It strikes me as weirdly Victorian. So I wanted to make sure if Bruno were a real creature, and basically I was thinking, if I were a talking chimpanzee, what would I do? What would I want? And I would think if he was a a chimpanzee, sex would be a part of his consciousness. And part of the thing that tortures Bruno is the fact that he has this powerful, libidinous, perverse attraction to human women, and he is a chimp, in particular to one human woman, Lydia, the woman that he falls in love with.
So do you think in writing about Bruno a little more, you learned more about chimpanzees or more about people?
People are always asking themselves what makes us human. But in a way, I think that that's barking up the wrong tree. It's a slightly wrong question to ask. And what we really ought to be thinking about is the fact that human beings are animals. And we should think more about what makes us similar and what ties us to other animals than about what separates us. I once saw Jane Goodall when I think I was about 15 or so. I saw her give a lecture, and I remember her saying, if there's anything that you take away from this talk, it's that all living things on this planet are far, far closer together than they are apart. An idea that is always stuck with me and kind of informed me, and certainly this book.
Writer Benjamin Hale. His novel is called The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore. Benjamin's mention of Jane Goodall sent us searching through our archives, looking for our last interview with her. Here's a short excerpt of Steve's interview.
Did you find yourself wondering what was happening inside the mind of a chimpanzee?
Constantly. I still maintain, if I could be inside the mind of a chimpanzee for just a few minutes, I would learn more about them than another goodness knows how many years of study, because we can guess what they're thinking, but how do they think? Are they thinking in pictures? How do you think without words? I spent ages thinking about that, wondering about it.
Were there any particular moments when you felt like you had a better understanding of that?
One moment was very, very special, and that was when I was sitting in the forest with David Greybeard, and I picked up a fruit and held it out to him, and he turned his head away, and I put my hand closer, and he turned, looking directly into my eyes. He reached out, took the fruit, dropped it. He really didn't want it. And then he very gently squeezed my hand, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. And so in that moment, we communicated in a way that seems to predate words, perhaps in a way that was used by our own common ancestor millions of years ago. And it was an extraordinary feeling. It was bridging these two worlds.
Sounds like you're very drawn to this whole idea of somehow knowing the world without language, without words.
I am fascinated by it. I always have been thinking. I mean, we think with words. And when we don't think with words, I think we come close to what mystics might describe as a mystical experience. Because I don't think that words would come into that.
Primatologist Jane Goodall. You can find the full conversation with Goodall, along with hundreds of other interviews, on our website at ttbook.org. Canadian novelist Colin McAdam also created fiction out of the world of chimpanzees. He wrote a novel called A Beautiful Truth, and Steve Paulson recently caught up with him.
Colin, this novel is about how complicated relationships can get. It's also about the nature of love, about loneliness. It's about chimpanzees. Why did you want to write about chimps?
Well, I think as I was going through all of those complications in my own life, I started to wonder where they came from. One thing that really stood out early for me was the genetic facts, I guess, the fact that, you know, if you take two species of dolphin, you know, one a subspecies of the other, they have less in common with each other genetically than we do with chimpanzees.
Hmm. Tell me about Louis, the central chimpanzee in your story. He's the chimp who's adopted. How does he fit into your novel?
Well, as I was learning all of these sort of facts about our connections with other apes, I realized that I really had to meet other chimpanzees. And so I went to a sanctuary that was near my house in Montreal at the time when I was writing this book, and this beautiful place called the Fauna Foundation, where a number of chimpanzees have been looked after for several years now, who were rescued from biomedical lab and from zoos and other places. And meeting them was a life-changing experience in many ways.
What life-changing? In what way?
I think these questions of will and empathy, these things that we take for granted as humans, or at least that we celebrate as humans, that we think are unique to us, I saw in the flesh among chimpanzees. There was one whom I was particularly fond of named Pepper. We had a connection, I guess. We looked into each other's eyes and had a nice few moments. And I have a small mole on my left hand. And she tried to reach through the bars to groom that for me, to sort of get that little speck of dirt off my hand for me. And it was a charming moment at the time. But when I learned more about her history and when I drove her away from the place, I suddenly thought, this is just the most extraordinary thing that I've just been a part of.
There was something about that reaching across species. That was the thing that got to you?
Partly that, but more than that, it was witnessing a being who had been in a cage for 30 years, in her case, still willing to reach out to help her captor, in a sense. I mean, that's one way of looking at that moment. And, you know, for me, it sort of conjured thoughts of people like Nelson Mandela, people like that, who have been through extraordinary things and somehow survive, and we celebrate them so roundly. And that's where Louis came from, I guess, is my really long answer.
Well, the central conceit of your story is that there is a couple in Vermont, Walt and Judy, who are desperate to have children, but they can't. So they adopt this chimpanzee, Louis, as kind of a way to fill this hole in their lives, and he turns their lives upside down. How would you describe Louis's life with this human couple, Walt and Judy?
Well, I based a lot of that side of the story on accounts I had read of similar situations. At the same time, I was in a house with a toddler, and you know, it wasn't a great leap to imagine this household being turned upside down if you combine basically the behavior of a human toddler with the agility of a chimpanzee. You've got a pretty crazy situation. Louis had an insatiable appetite for playing, and because of the weather in Vermont, it often meant that diversions were required indoors. He loved hide-and-seek, but sometimes played it when others didn't know he was playing. He climbed onto the mantel one afternoon and watched as Judy walked around the house calling his name. Louis, it's time to clean up the dining room. Come on, my little man, my Louis. When she came around the corner, he leapt from the mantel onto her shoulders. She lost control of her bladder. He then walked to the bathroom, took toilet paper, and ran around the house, unraveling it and laughing. Judy's concern was not her own emotional state so much as how he reacted to it. When he saw her fear or anger, he got frightened himself and he would run around screaming, trying to find comfort where he could until he felt he could touch her or get a hug. They usually found such delight in seeing how much he could do, though. He learned by observation, by staring and remembering. He learned to crack eggs. You sit up on the counter there. He held the electric beater. He could spread butter on his toast with a knife. It was rarely done with grace or without a mess, but they imagined he would one day be more careful. He loved to wear Walt's Skidoo helmet, which was half the size of his body. He wore it backwards and walked into furniture. He laughed every time he hit something, and it was impossible not to laugh when he laughed. Larry saw him do this, and Walt said, "Do other animals laugh?"
That is great. And I mean, it raises so many issues. As you say, there's something kind of childlike about Louis, and yet something utterly different as well. And you could just imagine that as Louis grows up, as he becomes a full-sized chimp, a wild animal, basically, a human household cannot contain him.
No. You know, if you combine the jealousies and politics and wants of children with a body that's 8 times stronger than a human adult, you know, there's inevitably going to be problems. It becomes frightening and dangerous. And I think most people know about Travis, for example, that chimpanzee who attacked a woman a few years ago.
She was badly mauled, right?
She was badly mauled, and it's a tragic story. You know, inevitably something will go wrong.
Now, I would think the challenge of writing a novel like this, where a chimpanzee is a major character in your story, is how do you create a character who doesn't have words?
Yeah, it was a challenge writing this thing. I'm kind of glad it's over in a way. When you look at the nature of apes, this issue of communication comes up. And we as humans sort of flatter ourselves for our linguistic abilities, and it's how we always define ourselves against what we call other animals. But the true nature of words and what we try to get from our words are really deeply embedded in ape nature. I see them as tools, and they come from the same place where in the brain where tool use is governed.
Well, you have kind of these alternating chapters in your novel where basically the story is told from the chimp's point of view. And I would love to have you do a reading for us. I mean, one of the passages where you do tell the story from the chimp's point of view.
Sure. Well, this one that I thought I'd read comes at a point where a chimp named Jonathan is being introduced to a group of other chimps who are what we would call friends at this point. The other chimps are named Mama, Poto, and Mr. Ghoul. Mama liked Jonathan and wanted to look after him like her doll that had one ear. He had tremendous balls. He sat and pressed his balls against the plector, and Mama felt a strange flush of oh when she touched them through the grid. Poto and Jonathan screamed at each other from either side of the plector, and Poto tried to hit him. They were all kept apart from him until one day Dave put Mama in the room with Jonathan while Mr. Ghoul and Poto watched from the other side. Mama's rosé was pink as a mouth, and she let Jonathan clean her neck and pin her. Whoo! And Poto and Mr. Ghoul were hanging from the plector and screaming and mounting each other for comfort. When Jonathan hung from his side of the plector, he looked like a wall of thorns and threats. They soon emerged in the playroom together. Jonathan and Poto groomed each other after bloning and bluffing. And it was grooming like a conversation between men is a test, not a connection. It was touching like you touch a suspect tree, not to sit in it, but to see what it will take to push it down. Jonathan was bigger than Poto. Mama seemed to want to please him no matter what he did, and Mr. Ghoul and Poto wanted to please Mama. Mr. Ghoul would feel drawn as much as obligated to groom Jonathan because awful people are strangely compelling. Strange smells are sniffed at, not once, but thrice.
That is great. I like the sound effects, too. Your book, A Beautiful Truth, is one of several novels that have come out in recent years that have fictionalized apes. And it strikes me that there's almost something in the zeitgeist here. Why do you think this is emerging as such a rich subject for fiction?
For me, it's such a fundamental part of who we are that to treat primatology, to treat chimpanzees as some sort of fringe concern seems all wrong to me. We don't question, you know, how many bloody vampire novels there are or books about enlightening texts in the Middle Ages that tell us secrets and all this sort of thing. We don't question that in the same way that we question why are there so many books about chimpanzees.
That's Colin McAdam talking with Steve Paulson about his novel, A Beautiful Truth. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. So what do you think about the similarities or the differences between humans and other apes? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can post your comments on our website at ttbook.org or on our Facebook page. Or you can follow us on Twitter. The handle's at ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Sarah Nix, with special audio wizardry from Joe Hartke. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.